Hey, everybody. Welcome to Roger and Me, aka Roger Ebert and Me, a movie review podcast that also functions as a tribute to Siskel and Ebert, hosted by myself, Brett Arnold, and film critic Mark Dusick of MarkReviewsMovies.com. We aim to cover every new theatrical release and every new streaming release every Friday, and we're doing it in the format pioneered by Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. That's really all you need to know about the show as far as I'm concerned. We're a guide to new release movies. We're already late this week. We usually run on Fridays because that's when new movies come out. But I was on vacation. I had to play catch up this weekend with some of the new releases. So it is Monday and we are here to cover six new release movies. Classic case of me slacking off because Mark did what looks to be 11 movies. And I just want to say one of those 11 is a movie I did see, but it was almost 2 years ago at a film festival. And it's a very COVID-centric movie, and it's only getting a release now. I don't know why. I guess because Bertrand Bonello's The Beast is like a very critically acclaimed movie that both you and I loved. And this was his previous film that kind of got lost in COVID. And Mark didn't like it very much. I liked it even less. So I didn't want to revisit that and talk about it. But there's a movie called Coma. You can read about it on MarkReviewsMovies.com. As for housekeeping stuff, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I did see a new one this week. Thank you to that person. Thank you so much. There's also a Q&A function on Spotify that I recently discovered. So if you want to ask Qs, we might post some A's at some point. I don't know. What's up, Mark?
Not much.
Perfect. Love it. Short and sweet. Let's get right into it with the six movies of the week. The biggest movie of the week, I guess, is a live action original, I'm going to put in quotes, original children's movie written and directed by noted auteur John Krasinski of the Quiet Place duology, I guess is what you'd call it as of the moment. There's a prequel coming, I believe, and maybe even a sequel to the second one. I don't know. But John Krasinski, this is his first non-quiet. Nope, that's not true. He did that brief interviews with Hideous Men movie, I think. So I always forget that he did that. But anyway, John Krasinski, kids movie. It's called IF, which stands for Imaginary Friends. Here's the trailer.
What if I told you imaginary friends are real? When their kids grow up, they're forgotten.
Are any of them scary?
Worse. Desperate.
Question, why did these kids forget about us in the first place?
Last week, I just started falling apart.
They're sucking the oxygen out of the room.
Honestly, Doc, if this is how it's going to be, I'm just going to wheel myself back and plug in.
We've started the matchmaking agency.
That trailer makes the movie look a little more focused than the actual finished product. I found this movie to be just flat out confusing in its basic setup of trying to be a movie about a kid with trauma in their life. But it seems like the trauma is really piled on to this kid. There's not just one parent that is, I'm sorry for the spoiler, there's a parent that dies of cancer in this movie at the very start. And then there's a second parent that is hospitalized for reasons that are very cagey and confusing. And then there's a whole, that has nothing to do with the plot about the imaginary friends, that feels shoehorned into this narrative. It's just a fucking mess, frankly. And it just feels like someone saw Pixar movies and was like, yeah, we could do that live action. Let's try. It's like a mashup of several Pixar concepts, including Monsters, Inc., a little bit of Inside Out, Bing Bong stuff. It has the up. I would argue the beginning is just trying to do the up montage, but less effectively. I found it to be totally a mess, and I don't think kids would find it enjoyable because it's so sad. It just piles on sadness, and it's not funny enough to justify it in the way that Pixar movies are like really specific and emotional and get you thinking about stuff. This one just is sad and confusing in a way that never really congealed for me. What did you think of IF?
It's very narratively confused, considering the fact that it has such a straightforward premise of imaginary friends are real. This little girl can see them and she's going to try to help them. It's all there in the trailer, but the movie takes a good hour or so, I think, before it actually sets that up officially, that this is what they're trying to do. And then it just kind of, I think it does find its footing near the end, but that's after watching, you know, an hour and 20 something minutes of it, just sort of coming up with ideas and not really doing anything with them. The big draw here, I think, is just the visual effects, the character designs of the ifs, and the vocal cast that Krasinski apparently, I guess he's on the level of Seinfeld with Unfrosted, where you just make a phone call and to anybody and they'll say yes, because who's in this? Everybody's in this, basically. George Clooney, let's go with him right at the top. George Clooney has like two lines of dialogue as this astronaut, but you know, Krasinski can call him up apparently. It's he'll come in for like a couple hours in the recording studio for him.
I feel like a lot of people sent voice notes on their phone into
Krasinski. I forgot about that about how technology has advanced. They probably didn't even need
I don't think Clooney or Cooper or Matt Damon or Bill Hader or Keegan Michael Key or Richard Jenkins or Blake Lively or Sebastian Maniscalco or Christopher Maloney or Matt Rise or Sam Rockwell or Maya Rudolph or Amy Schumer or John Stewart or Brad Pitt. I don't think any of those people showed up for a second. Maybe Steve Carell and Phoebe Waller-Bridge did, because they're more central to the cast. But I just kept reading names because there were so fucking many.
Yeah,
so you're right.
There were so many.
A lot of cameos in that regard, and they don't really do much for me because the characters aren't that interesting, and they kind of just show up to be like, well, here's our concept of imaginary friends, so here's a few of them. Do you get it? Let's move on. It just piles on these sad things like parent death and existential crises from the imaginary friends themselves, who like disappear when kids forget about them. And
We think that's what happens, because we never actually see it happen. And that's part of the reason it doesn't quite work, is that it doesn't go to that dark level. It doesn't even hint at the darkness. It's even when you brought up about the father, who's played by Krasinski, is in the hospital with a broken heart that needs to be fixed. And I don't know what they were implying. I don't know if it was mental health crisis because of the death of his wife. I don't know if it was actual heart surgery.
That's a great point, because in my mind I go, he's having heart surgery, but he doesn't know how to tell his kid that in a fun way. So he's like, life is beautifuling life for his daughter and telling her that things are, you know, better than they actually are. So he's like, yeah, I have a broken heart, like, you know, because mom died. That's why I'm in the hospital. But it's like, okay, so you're right. Is it a mental health crisis? Are you depressed? Is that why you're in the hospital? Are you having open heart surgery? It seems like you are, but I don't know. And that's insane that I don't know. And the movie just does not define things like that in a way that it leaves you going, wait, what? What's going on? And I felt that most of the way through the movie. Like, what's going on? Especially with when Ryan Reynolds is introduced and you're like, okay, so why is he involved in all of this? And then ultimately you find out why, and it's pretty obvious that that's what it is. I kind of guessed that.
Yeah, I guessed that pretty early on too.
Yeah. Much sense of like, why would it be like that? If you interrogate it falls apart.
If you interrogate any of this, it all falls apart because the Reynolds character is inherently creepy from the start, because the first time you see him, he's sneaking into a child's room.
Yeah.
Ostensibly, you know, to get this imaginary friend who's auditioning to become this little girl's imaginary friend. But it's still like, why are you introducing a character like this? Obviously, by the end, it makes some kind of sense. But that raises an entire different issue, because the little girl's hanging around with a stranger the entire movie. And then when you find out at the end what's going on, you're like, well, the little girl is doing this other thing. You're like, these are both really bad lessons to tell kids. It's a weird thing. But it's
You know, if there was a random stranger and you woke up and he was in your room, he probably would say something like, I'm chasing the imaginary friend I thought was in here.
like there's a big purple monster named Blue.
Yeah.
I see Dave.
It's like, yeah, that is the kind of stuff crazy people say when they break into your house. So yeah, it doesn't, even if it's going for a laugh there, it doesn't really go for a laugh there in that way. So the movie is just this unearned sentimentality just wrapped around it, and it never earns it. It never justifies it by like having a plot that makes sense for the characters. I just found it to be so boring and confusing, and just really felt like first draft. Okay, I watched a bunch of Pixar movies in one weekend. Let's just mash them up and, you know, have the guy who shot Schindler's List shoot it, Janusz Kaminski is the cinematographer. So it has this nice look to it, kind of. And the visual effects aren't bad looking or anything. It just, I think, as you said, interesting concept that needed a little help in the narrative department, because it is an absolute mess of a movie. I think I said all I have to say about If. That's a 1.5-star movie for me. And I really don't think kids would get much out of it, because it really is just maudlin concept after maudlin concept. Like, I don't think any kid would care about the nuances of parent death. I don't know. Monsters, Inc., I just think of all the Pixar movies that deftly handle such emotional material. And I just look at this and you're like, this is not handled deftly or even like competently in a way that I know what's happening on that level. So it just feels like a misfire in kind of every way. And Krasinski's like, I'm the best dad in the world. I'm not going to let my daughter see how hurt I am. That whole thing is not just, it's boneheaded. I think it's confusing. And I just hated his character so much. I mean, I thought it was terrible.
Isn't kind of the point of having that, of him, the character, of the father character, try to deflect from what's going on and make his daughter feel comfortable? Isn't eventually the arc of that, you would think, like, to actually have the serious conversation at some point? Like, this is what's going on with me. I understand now that you are more grown up because of what you went through, and I'm going to actually talk to you about these things in the future so that we can communicate. Isn't that kind of what you would think would happen? And it never happens, because it's so distracted once again by having the imaginary friends be reunited with their adults, which I found kind of touching, like the Bobby Moynihan scene.
Yeah.
And I think there's one other one. I'm not 100% sold on what the movie's selling with that, but it still worked for me. Like, this idea that the entire point of having an imaginary friend as a kid is that you need comfort and you need some kind of companionship that's not there. And as an adult, we still need those feelings sometimes. And so I found it affecting by the end, but that's probably more of a fluke than anything else, just because it is trying to tug at your heartstrings so much. Eventually it got me in like one element of it. That's to say, I'm giving it 2 stars, and I really feel like I overrated it with 2 stars when we started talking about it. So yeah, here we go. That's where we're at.
When I was playing catch up and seeing these movies yesterday, I actually ended up seeing, it was like a screening of Garfield for next week, and then I saw Back to Black right after that, and then I saw If right after that.
Oh,
and strangely, I think Garfield might have been the best of the three, which I don't know if you'll agree with.
We'll talk about that next week.
We'll talk about that next week.
We'll talk about that this week. I'm sorry.
Yes, this week, because we're late, of course. 2 stars from Mark for If, 1.5 for me. Just a mess that doesn't work on any level for me. But hey, it got Mark to the emotional point it needed to, so maybe it works in some degree. Let's talk about The Strangers, Chapter 1. I don't know how we're going to talk about this without spoiling things, because I don't know what is a spoiler or it isn't for this movie. We'll talk about it. Here's the trailer.
Do you know what today is?
Today is the third day of our 3-day road trip across the country.
Or our 5-year anniversary. What a cool little town. I actually like this so much better than a hotel. I'll bet the people who live here are really happy.
Tough crowd, right?
Hi.
Hi.
Do you hear that?
Hear what?
The silence. It's nice.
The Strangers, Chapter 1. This is part one of a planned trilogy of Strangers movies that are all coming out in quick succession. This one is out now, obviously, in May. The next one's allegedly done and coming out in, you know, the October timeframe. And then the next one is allegedly coming out in January. So it's like an experiment of trying to get these three movies out quickly. They shot all of them in like 55 days or something. And I would argue it shows a little bit that they shot this quickly in The Strangers Part 1, Chapter 1. I don't know what your expectations were, Mark, but I try to avoid trailers. I just heard Strangers Chapter 1. I read a little about what the producers had said, and they said that I felt it was going to be some sort of prequel situation. I don't know if that was stupid of me, but let's be clear to what this movie is. Largely, just a lesser version of the original movie. It's a remake. it feels like if the plan is to do a trilogy, I guess their plan was we start with a remake of the first one. And then what? Is the second one going to be a remake of the second movie? Just kidding. It's clearly it's not, because the second movie was a narrative leap away. So this one's clearly following the same person. It's like a Final Girl situation. It just made Strangers such a typical horror movie in its construction this time, where the original had its like, it was exciting because there was like, you know, no motivation other than you were home and that's why they did it. And that was the big reveal. It was this like long, intense scene where she's being home invaded and you're just actually scared with her. And this one adds all this like just window dressing horror shit. Like they pull up in the town with the, you know, gas station with the locals who give them looks like, look at these out of towners. And it's clearly setting up suspects that you aren't supposed to care about, which isn't the fucking point of the Strangers movies. That's supposed to be like, who's under the mask? It doesn't matter. It's not what it's about. And I would also argue that making the lead in these movies a final girl is also not what it's about. Like, I don't need to see the continuing adventures of one of these people. The whole point of this is supposed to be the brutality of the crime. This one actually opens with text that is like, there are this many million crimes in the U.S. There are very violent crimes everywhere. This is one of the most brutal. And then it goes forth, and frankly, I don't know how you felt, very, very tame of a horror movie when you're expecting something that starts with, this is one of the most brutal crimes you'll ever see. It's barely, the kills are not particularly egregious or whatever. It just really plays like a lesser version of the original movie, which I had happened to watch an hour before watching this. And it's amazing how it's just the same movie, but done worse at every level. And even to the point of like that line I mentioned, like the because you were home line is essentially in this movie, but said a little differently. So it's just a bad remake of The Strangers with the promise of more to come that I don't particularly want. And I can't imagine most people being like, yeah, I am very interested in like the religious cult aspect that they're clearly setting up in this town and all these other little details that are just like barely mentioned. And before we get to the Strangers portion of the home invasion, The Strangers 2008 is good enough. I enjoy it. I like Strangers Pray at Night as well. This one is not good enough for me to get past the, I've seen this movie before. And if you haven't seen The Strangers in 2008, maybe this would play a lot better. I think it would, but you should just watch that one instead.
Well, I think it would definitely play better because at least on one level, the familiarity would be gone. But this does just become a generic horror movie, including the introduction of the strangers killing somebody else, which kind of gives away the entire game of what they're up to. Because the original Strangers, I'm not a fan of the original Strangers. I'm a big fan of Pray at Night.
Okay.
Kind of infamously big fan of Pray at Night. But you don't know exactly what the strangers are up to in that first one in the beginning, because they seem almost to be more like pranksters. And that annoyed me about the original, was that they just the stakes of what is going on in the house as they're doing the invasion and kind of messing with the heads of that couple, to have that cruelty at the very end come out of, for me, nowhere, even though I knew it's a horror movie and all that. It just like this, it all escalates so quickly that it doesn't pay off for me. This one has the opposite problem, where you already know what's going to happen if you saw The Strangers, because you know exactly where this is going to go, and it follows it beat by beat. But it also ruins it for people who haven't seen the original by having that opening cliched horror movie prologue where you see the killers kill somebody, because now you know these guys are killers and they're going to kill some people if they get in there.
Right.
It's really bad. It's really, really bad. And it features, and this is saying something, I think, two of the stupidest protagonists I've seen in a horror movie recent memory.
Okay.
They are.
Let's talk about it. I was laughing out loud, frankly, in this empty movie theater in Reno, Nevada, where I saw this movie, at the lead character, Madeline Petch. Is that her name? The girl from Riverdale. She's the lead. The Liv Tyler character to this other random guy, Scott Speedman. She has the chillest response to being home invaded ever. I couldn't believe what I was watching. She's being home invaded. Like, there clearly are people outside. They're knocking on the windows. Yes, they're kind of just fucking with her before she knows that they're in there. But as Mark pointed out in his review, if she would have like a little peripheral vision or her neck on a swivel, she could see that the people are just constantly behind her in the house at all times. But that's
she just
that,
needs
that's
to turn her head like 45 degrees. Yeah. That's it. Just 45 degrees.
That's the movie. The movie's just trying so hard to emulate the same tricks as the original that worked, like lurking in the background unseen, which every movie since then has stolen. So it's like remaking a thing that was influential. It doesn't really work. You know what I mean? Because we've already seen it a million times. So that stuff sucks. But the response to the home invasion is her to smoke a joint and hang out, play the piano a little bit, play the piano for a stranger. She didn't really know she was giving a concert performance, but she was. And she also takes a shower which the stranger watches. So it's just completely non-reality, like completely take you out of the movie stuff where you're like, they can't even get the fundamentals of how a person would react during a home invasion correctly. It's just like everything is so stupid. And then, you know, it has the same setup as the first one where like the girl gets left alone for a while before the guy comes back. And then he comes back and then he does the stupidest shit you've ever seen with regard to when he uses guns and when he doesn't use guns.
He's so trigger happy. The first time he gets a shotgun, he is like, oh yeah, I'm going to shoot the first thing I see. And then later in the movie, he's like,
yeah,
no, you know what? You've been terrorizing us all night and you clearly want to kill us, but you know what? I'm going to give you a chance.
What? Maybe him using the shotgun that time is supposed to inform the fact that he doesn't use it later, but it doesn't make any fucking sense.
No, it doesn't, because he directly says, I've already killed somebody. So it's not going to be much harder to kill a second person, but apparently it is because the script needs him not to do that.
There's just frankly nothing scary about a movie that you've seen before beat by beat. And that's really what this is. Same aesthetic as the original. Just everything's a little shittier. They do the same record player tricks, and the specter of a sequel doesn't aid anything. It ruins the impact of anyone can die at any moment, which is the whole fucking thing with the strangers. I thought instead it's like, Survivor, let's get to the next one. Like it's just a lot of treading water and wheel spinning to get to a final confrontation that is so lame and it gives you nothing. Like this movie does not have an ending. It just basically says come back for the next one. So it fails to deliver, frankly, on the expectations it sets for itself within those opening text crawl about the violent crimes. It just is so tame and so lame. And frankly, everything it does is antithetical to why the original worked.
Yeah, and I don't even think the original worked. This is lesser than that. Even not thinking the first one is that good or good at all. This is below that. So I mean, that's it. That's it. Even fans of The Strangers don't like this, and non-fans think it's worse. So it's really bad.
I wonder how this trilogy will do, because it's one of those things where it's like, it's horror. They kept the budget low. That movie cost $8.5 million to make, allegedly, and it made $13 million already this weekend. So it's close to doubling its money in a single weekend. So like, will the other two do that same amount? I feel like they will probably. Is there going to be a contingent of people who feel spurned by the ending here who won't show up? Or are people really hooked with the Madeline Petch is the final girl in this series thing? Like, I just don't know. It pisses me off, frankly. This whole thing is stupid, but I'm glad to see horror doing well at the box office no matter what it is. So I guess I'll just say that. Let's move on to the Amy Winehouse biopic called Back to Black. Here's a trailer.
I want people to hear my voice.
Amy! No! No!
And just forget their troubles for 5 minutes.
Go, go, go.
Do you know what girl power means to me? Sarah Vaughan, Lauryn Hill. You need to know this. I ain't no Spice Girl. From primary school.
No, no, no.
To sell out concerts. It's gonna happen one of these days. Boys like yours, got to.
What is one of the best of it ever?
This is a confusing and frustrating movie for me, Mark, because I didn't think it was like horrible or terrible like a lot of people do. I think it's a good performance that has the like unfortunate like nature of it is that you can't do an impression of a person who is so their own person. They're so unique. Her whole thing is the way she talks, the way she looks, the way she sings. And it's so specific to her that even when it's a good performance emulating that, it's hard not to feel like you're watching someone dressed in like a rockabilly girlfriend Halloween costume or something. And this movie reminded me, Mark, of like, you know how if you've ever been to karaoke at like a bar where it's open and you're on a stage, there's always one person there who goes way too hard and imitates the singer to an embarrassing degree, but like they're actually pretty good at it and it's actually impressive to you. You're like, wow, that person's really good. But it's also kind of sad because it's like the back of a bar at 2 a.m. and it's not like Carnegie Hall or wherever they think they are. That's what this movie feels like. Like, it is not bad. Like, I'm like, she's good. That's a pretty good Amy Winehouse impression. But I can't help but you just know what you're watching is a facsimile and not the real thing. And when there is a real thing as good as the A24 documentary Amy from like 2015, like, it just doesn't, this movie never justifies itself because it can't help but feel a little phony, right? Is that a problem you had with it too?
It does feel phony because, I mean, we all know the story of Amy Winehouse, especially if you grew up during it, because she was everywhere and all of her, you know, issues with substances and, you know, addiction and the relationship and all that. It was everywhere. You couldn't escape it. And that's what's so great about the documentary Amy is that it tackles all of that. It tackles this idea of fame and what people do to famous people and how they just kind of dismiss them as human beings because they're famous, and that's apparently enough of an excuse to be able to like make jokes about very serious troubles they're having. This movie kind of just, I don't even know, it doesn't address it in any way. It's just, yeah, she was an alcoholic, and eventually because she dated this guy she started using harder drugs, and that's it. That's all you need to know, apparently. It doesn't explore anything like where does this come from, or if it is part of her personality, what actually was going on behind the scenes. It's so busy doing the usual music biography route of just like, here's the greatest hits and here's the concert sing,
here's her picking up the guitar and playing that song for the first time that you know.
I think when it actually does serve as a drama, when it focuses on that toxic relationship, It works a little bit better because it's this intimate drama that's between two characters who become codependent. It's an interesting idea to play that relationship just in a straightforward manner to just kind of see like how this happened and what the effects of it were on her. But then it just shoves all that aside too. Just like all of this weird armchair psychoanalysis of why like she really wanted kids. Apparently,
the movie gets obsessed with that. Yeah,
really obsessed with it. And I don't know why that's the angle they went with.
I can tell you why. It's a weird one. It's one of those like approved by the estate things. And it's like her dad had control over this. And he comes off looking not as, you know, like a good guy.
There's very specific.
Yeah, it's just like one of those things where they don't tell the story the way it should be told because they don't want to offend anybody involved or something. And it's like,
that's not the story.
And the music isn't staged very excitingly. And man, there's some really clunky, like Walk Hard style biopic tropey shit in this. Like there's one part where she's singing and her like producer goes to her and just is like, wow, I can't believe you're only 18 years old right now. And I was like, what? I can't believe you just said that. It just is really clunky about telling its story. So it's not that good. I agree. Those charming meet cute moments with the really toxic boyfriend are when the movie's at its best, but it also plays weird because those moments are like heavily romanticized in a way where you're like, this is toxic and ultimately bad. But I guess the idea is like, this is how she would have seen it. Like from her perspective,
exactly.
Like it would have been this intoxicating, nice thing. And you do get that feeling. So like, it's well done in that regard, but all that gets dropped at a certain point. You're right. It just has all the tropes you'd expect of the biopic thing. It feels like it's ticking boxes. It's doing the Wikipedia page thing. Despite a good performance, despite a good job of imitating her, it's just like, it's impossible to do this impression without seeming over the top, without seeming like you're, because she's so pronounced in the way she speaks and the way she moves that when you're doing it, it's hard to feel like you're doing anything but an impression of it. So while that's good, it just comes across like at best, this is like someone good at karaoke. You know what I mean? It's weird. And the movie isn't good enough to justify any of that. Just watch the documentary. It's a 2-star movie for me. Back to Black.
Yeah, Back to Black's 2 stars for me too. But that documentary is really, really good. That won the Oscar too, so well deserved. I know some people give it crap because of the Google Maps element of it, but it's like, come on, there's so much more going on in that movie.
Yeah, I watched it on the plane back home right before I saw it for the first time. So it was another thing where it's like, didn't do the movie any favors to watch the better version.
Oh, no, it does not.
But you know,
especially you. Yeah, you brought up the point. Right. I didn't want to bring it up in my review or really much now. But yeah, the entire family angle and the people who could have taken advantage of her celebrity and maybe not. Yes. Or maybe have overlooked.
Oh, God. Yeah.
All of her issues. And this
documentary. Yeah, the documentary gets into like, well, Amy says she doesn't want to tour right now. And she's really fucked up. And there's a part in the documentary where, like, she's so fucked up that they throw her on a plane and she ends up in Serbia, where she's supposed to be for her concert, like, barefoot at the airport. And it's like, her fucking family did that. The people closest to her did that to her. And the movie the movie shies away from anything controversial to just be, like, a sanitized, oh, poor, look at her thing. It's a bummer. Disappointing. Good performance, though, frankly.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. Yeah, good performance of the lead. Marissa Abella. There, we got to say the name.
Yeah, she's great. British person, I would imagine, who I had never seen before. Apparently, she's in a popular show called Industry that I've heard is good. But yeah, definitely looking forward to whatever she does next without the Amy Winehouse hairdo thing going on. Anyway, let's talk about Babes, a movie directed by Pamela Adlon, starring Alana Glazer and Michelle Buteo.
Are you good, dude?
I need you to check my shit.
Oh my God, you're in labor. I don't know the medical term for this, but your vagina looks like it's yawning. Like,
I don't want to get birthed, I love it!
Y'all need to get out
and
transfer.
Wait, hold up.
Hey, did I ask you?
Thank you. Today I saw a baby being born.
Are you so proud of you?
Don't touch me! Oh my
hand! I need it.
Clyde.
Dawn, crisis. I've had sex, but I was on my period.
So
you can't get pregnant on your period.
Girl,
stop.
Girl, you stop. We went to the same school. We learned the same shit.
A lot of this movie will depend on your, you know, if you are a fan of Alana Glazer's humor and their shtick back and forth. Like, that's a good example. I thought that was funny. This movie's full of banter like that. It's full of actually honest, a very honest depiction of like the absurdities of having a baby, the female body, the pregnancy part, the things people usually don't talk about because it's too gross. It does have, it's about those things. It's about the uncomfortableness of third wheeling as a friend when your friends are married and have kids and you're just still trying to be their friend and what that's about. I would say all those things end up resolving in very predictable manners. And this movie is generally a very predictable little, like, I wouldn't call it a rom-com, but like, the rom of it is like kind of like a friendship romance. It's kind of like a friendship comedy more so than a rom-com. I'm ultimately giving this a 3-star review, just so you know. I found it to be very funny, very honest. As someone who just had a kid, watched this with my wife, who we were laughing throughout at the like specific jokes about like how big the needle is when they do that thing where they have to shove it inside you to test for defects. Like, that needle, whatever she says about it, is so fucking funny. Her reaction to it. She's like, that needle is huge or something. Like, this is a huge reaction. Very cut, stupid, big reactions. But it's funny. And, you know, the realities of being a parent, how it's an endless loop of other people's needs all the time. And, like, all those things are really good. My big problem with it and why I'm, like, 3 stars on it, or 3 out of 5 instead of 3.5 out of 5, if you care about that nuanced bullshit, is that it just, like, I love Pamela Adlon. She's an incredible actress, writer, and now director of this movie. She does a great show called Better Things on FX that might be memory hold because it was a Louis C.K. production situation. Anyway, she's very talented, but something about the direction of this movie is it just that the movie's so cheap that it just looks a little cheap, or it's just, like, edited together in a way that's, like, highlights the improvisation so it feels a little lesser formed than like a more cohesive version of this movie. It's a little rough around the edges, I guess, is my point. But I found it to be very funny and charming, and there's a great running bit with John Carroll Lynch, aka the Zodiac Killer from Zodiac, and I really enjoyed that. And I found it was, like, you know, if you're in the mood for a comedy, I thought it was very funny, and I just wonder if, like, the cheap indie nature of it will work for everybody. I guess
I didn't mind the cheap indiness of it. I didn't mind it because it's doing so many things well. All the jokes are really funny. That opening scene, of just kind of delaying labor is hilarious. It's a great scene for all the jokes that it's doing, and also because it sets up that relationship and those specific characters so well, just as all of the jokes are going. I really, really like this friendship because it is direct and it's frank about the fact that eventually these two characters are kind of splitting apart and there's a rift between them and there's tension between them, and it plays that out in an honest way. It actually says, like, you know, maybe they have changed enough that something is off here. And so you see that going on as the movie's going, but you also sense just how connected the two of them are, and you really hope it works out in the way a good rom-com. It is kind of like a friendship rom-com, you want it to work out for them because they work together so well. The two actors work together so well.
Like, did you get a little teary at the end? Like, it's doing what it should do. Like, it gets you there.
It's doing exactly what it needs to do. Yep. I have no problem with how it does it and where it goes, and or the indiness of it. I can't say it. I didn't mind it. I think it's funny. I think it's telling a story about long-term friendships that doesn't just make it seem all happy and rosy. Sometimes it's hard. It's because it's any relationship that goes on for a while. It can be hard at times. It just happens. So I really like that. And yeah, you're right. The John Carroll Lynch running gag with the hair is just great. Just great.
Like, the joke is so funny that, like, it doesn't even have to, you don't even have to wait for the punchline part because it just cuts to the scene and he has a different hair problem. And you're like, oh God, this is great.
You see it ahead of time. And that's what makes it funny, is that you know the punchline before the joke shows up, and it's still funny. So it's funny two times. It's funny because you hear the punchline, you see the punchline, and they set it all up, and it's funny as they're setting it up. I liked it. I've given it, you know, 3 stars to, but I might have liked it a little bit more than you did, but whatever, those don't matter. We both liked it.
It's splitting hairs. I really liked it, and I recommended it to everybody I can think of, and it gets at the realities of the miracle of birth in ways that, like, my wife and I talk about all the time. Like, it's crazy we're not all talking about this. Like, when she's like, I'm growing a penis potentially inside of my vagina, and then later, so maybe it's like, oh my God, I'm growing a vagina inside my vagina, how fucking weird is that? And like, that stuff is all very true. You do feel all that stuff. And like, the idea of like a birth plan and how she wants to have like a prom themed birth plan. Like, it's just so funny. It's really funny. I've seen people who did not like Broad City, do not like Alana Glazer, and found this to be completely grating. And I guess I understand that, but I've never felt that way. I've always been enough of a fan of her. I say enough because she did a stand-up special and it was frankly unwatchable and one of the worst things I've ever seen. But like, I think she's a very talented writer and actress, and it's very clear. Like, this is a movie that she wrote. She has a 2-year-old child, and it just it very much feels like when I saw this, I was like, oh, I didn't know Alana had kids, and the movie made it clear to me that she did because of how honest it was about having a kid. And I want to say maybe they shot it while she was pregnant, because like, there were shots in it where I'm like, there she is, she looks pregnant. Maybe they did, you know, movie magic, but maybe they did shoot this a couple of years ago. I think her kid's only 2 years old. Anyway. It's funny, it's good, and now I remember the line she says is, that needle is nuts, like that, but like, really, it's funny. Shtick withstanding, you may not, if you don't know if you like her shtick, give it a try. Michelle Buteo is also very funny, two very funny people. Yeah, it's just a funny, honest movie about having kids and growing up and all that stuff, and it may be a little rough around the edges because of, I don't know, cheapness or amateur behind the camera stuff, but none of that gets in the way of of how funny it is. I really enjoyed it. 3 stars for sure. All right, the next movie. Oh, this will be interesting. We're gonna disagree. This is a movie Ethan Hawke made, wrote and directed with his daughter Maya Hawke as the star, and it's not his first time directing. You may think so because it's like actors do that all the time. He's been directing for maybe 20 years plus. Like, he's directing for a long time. Here's the trailer for Wildcat.
The sky was underpinned with long silver streaks that looked like scaffolding, but no one was paying any attention to the sky.
Well, I don't understand why you don't want to write something that people would like to read.
Dear God, I want to write a novel. A good novel.
This is the first time I've ever really thought anything of Maya Hawke. I thought she was very good in this. And I think it's a tough role in the way that the movie's structured. She has to not just be Flannery O'Connor. She has to embody all her characters, several different characters across several different short stories. And I know your fundamental flaw is that you don't think it works at all the way that it does that. I found that to be the stroke of genius, brilliant thing that made it work, where it's this biopic biography structure mixed in with adaptations of her short stories that I found to be incredibly informative of her upbringing and her life. And the really clever, the way that she is the character in it and her mom is always a character in it, and how it just gets at the inherent reality of fiction writing in a way that, like, I can't think of a movie off the top of my head that did it that deftly, where I was like kind of taken with like just the directorial method of it. I'm like, wow, that was a good choice. And I think, you know, it's a movie about Flannery O'Connor tackling tough subjects that, you know, accost the readers and make them feel bad. And everyone's always telling her, why can't you write nice things? Because she's writing about like casual racism or whatever else. And I don't know, man. This is a genre I loathe, invigorated with at least something different structurally, that by the end, the final shot with the fucking peacock thing, I really was like, I got goosebumps with it. I thought the moving away from the window to look at her whole life history and accept that as a springboard for her art, I just completely was won over by this movie in a way that you clearly were not. And I think that it's just like, Ethan Hawke has made a few movies about artists and art, and like a biopic. He's made another biopic, or he starred in Born to Be Blue. I don't know if he had anything to do with that one. But like, I feel like watching an artist talk about artists is interesting to me. And I found it interesting, I think, because of the meta context of like knowing Ethan Hawke and who he is and why he's fascinated with what he's fascinated by. And yeah, you know, writing isn't an escape from reality. It is reality, whatever that opening title card is. I just think it like sets up what it's doing and then does it in a way that moved me. I thought this was very good and better than most biopics that I usually don't like. So why didn't it work for you?
It didn't work for me because it just, the structuring of it just, it assumes too much. It assumes that Flannery O'Connor just blatantly inserted herself and her family and the people around her, like that she knows intimately, into her stories to an extent that those are the things that inform and define her as a person and her relationship with her mother, instead of actually just showing that to us by way of the biography elements. There's a disconnect in my head, and that's, it might just be me, I always have this hard time when it comes to movies that and anything that assumes a writer is just always self-inserting. Like, yeah, you don't have to. Some people do, some people don't, but just the assumption that this is who Flannery O'Connor is through her stories, it didn't work for me. That's all it is, and that's probably just like a personal bias I have. I don't know why. I think sometimes you can pull it off. I don't think this movie does it, because it is so invested in the adaptations of the stories that I think it shortchanges the biographical.
Yeah, which are cool.
No, but that's the problem with it. That's what I don't like, because I don't know who Flannery O'Connor is by way of her actual story in this movie. I only know who Flannery O'Connor is in this movie by way of those short stories. And I don't think that gets at it. I don't think it entirely gets at it.
Are you bringing in pre-Flannery O'Connor knowledge that I just don't have?
A little bit, because there's still a lot of, like, I mean, it's always up in the air when you're talking about an author, you know, who's been dead for decades. Like, what was the person like? I watched it. There's a documentary about her called Flannery, which is pretty good, and it delves into racism within her work and around her and potentially from her.
Like tries to scapegoat her mother and say that she was just out racism.
This is what I'm getting at, is that if you even just thinking, like, there's a possibility Flannery O'Connor might have had some racist thoughts of her own, this movie basically just gets tossed out the window.
That's a good point. I didn't consider just being rose-colored glasses about everything, I guess.
But that's like a small point. My biggest point is that by focusing so much on those adaptations, it shortchanges the biography. It doesn't give you a sense of who Flannery O'Connor is, I think, within the movie itself. That's my big problem with it. It's all about contextualized within the movie. I think all that other stuff that I'm talking about, assuming the characters in the not in the books are, or in the short stories are actual people.
So
ignoring all that stuff. That's just for me, that just proves the limitations of this format and this structure. That's all I'm saying about that.
I guess it's one of those things where you could watch it and say, well, it's more about Ethan Hawke's artistic process than Flannery's. And maybe that's true. But I found it, as someone who knows nothing about Flannery O'Connor, straight up will admit that, like, I found it to be maybe the things I learned from it, I found it to be informative. Maybe they're completely wrong, and I take away
what Ethan wants me to think.
Yeah,
it really, like, really doesn't matter. That's what I'm getting at. Is that it's like, yeah, there is all this outside baggage of all of her actual works and all that stuff. But who cares about that? The movie should tell a convincing story, and it didn't tell. I wasn't convinced by its story.
To me, it's more about, like, writing writ large than it's about Flannery O'Connor, I guess, and how it's like we put ourselves into it or don't. But, like, if that's not what if that's not something she's ever talked about or admitted, or, like, then I'm like, okay, well, weird that Ethan made a movie about this. But my perspective is, I found it very fascinating from that point of view. And let's just say, Mark, there's a cameo in this movie that I was particularly taken with.
Yes.
That's all we'll say about that.
That's all I'll say.
I was even taken two with it, maybe even taken three with it. that was really stupid. 3 stars for me from Wildcat, Ethan Hawke movie. He also, I noticed, I think you've liked everything else he's directed besides this.
That I've seen, because I know I liked
Blaze. You liked Blaze, and you liked Seymour, An Introduction, right?
Okay,
did you see that?
Go.
Remember that movie about the guy who's like a pianist and author or something. I remember seeing
I
that
might have missed that one.
No, you reviewed it.
I did? Oh, well, thank you. Good to know. Good
you
to
gave
know
it a good review. It. Yeah, yeah. You've
okay,
liked,
there we go.
I definitely checked your Ethan Hawke.
Oh, look at that. Reviewed.
See. Yeah,
hey, look at that.
I definitely checked to
see. I don't do my homework on this.
No, it's fine. I was like, does Mark not like the work of Ethan Hawke? And it's like, no, you do. And you just did not care for this movie.
Yeah, it's just this movie didn't work for me just because of the contrivance of everything. So I'm giving it 2 stars.
Okay.
I would really like to see like a Flannery O'Connor anthology movie like this one sets up. That would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Or an actual biography of Flannery O'Connor. Either one would be really good.
You will not accept this hybrid. You want two individual movies.
It is not working for me. It did not work for me.
I like that we had different reactions to that one, because I didn't expect anything from it and I was expecting to be bored by it, and I was really moved. I don't know if moves the right word, but I found it very captivating in a, like, ooh, I see what he's doing here and I like it. And I could see that not working for sure. 3 stars for me. Let's move on to the last movie of the week, which is a weird one. It's a legacy horror sequel, I guess, to a cult hit Danish movie from 1994. Called Night Watch, that I believe was remade in America with Ewan McGregor in 1997. Same title, not to be confused with Timur Bekmambetov's They Watch Night Watch movies. So it's very confusing to me, but it's a sequel to the 1994 movie that stars Nikolai Coster-Waldau, the guy from he became a big star with Game of Thrones, and he's kind of always been around for a while. There's a sequel to this movie. It is on Shudder. It's called Night Watch Demons Are Forever, which I in my head hear as the James Bond Diamonds Are Forever, and now I put that in your head. So do with that what you will. Here is the trailer for Night Watch Demons Are Forever.
It's going to be cast. What? If I'm can do something.
I guess that kind of set up the first movie, but why don't you tell us what the first movie is and then what this movie is?
The first movie is weird because this entire thing is weird. This entire scenario is really weird because the Danish original never got a U.S. release. I looked this up. It never got a U.S. release.
I thought I was losing my mind. No, I had to ask Shudder for a screener and they gave me one. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, they were offering them up for press so that we could actually see the original movie, because it had never come out in the United States until Shudder put it out. Because of the remake, I think it was Dimension Films. Dimension Films basically hid.
Weinstein, baby.
Yeah. So they basically hid the Danish movie. And it, you know, the remake
that
didn't
was
do
classic.
Well.
That was classic, yeah. Weinstein shit. Like, buy
that
a
was,
porn thing,
yeah.
Remake it, and bury it. Yep.
And bury it. Bury the original so we could never ever.
It's written
see
by
it.
Fucking Steven Soderbergh, man. It's crazy.
Yeah. So anyway,
crazy.
So watching it was very strange because I saw the remake, but I don't remember much about it, obviously, because it was 97 or 8, I think you said.
Yeah, 97.
But so I don't remember much about it.
Oh, no, actually, but it came out in April 98. It must have been like thing in 97 or something.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't remember it. So watching the original again the original for the first time after having seen the remake so long ago, I'm assuming all of the weird comedy stuff. All the sex comedy stuff is probably not in the remake, and it's really off-putting. And I kind of get what they're going for in the original movie of just having like these young men so caught up in like their obsessions with sex and all this stuff that they're not grown up. And so by the end, going through all this experience of having a serial killer stalk them and kill people around them, I guess is supposed to make them more grown up, but you know, whatever. It's weird watching the first movie and then seeing the second one. And I almost would recommend skipping the first movie because the tone of the second one is so completely different. It is a very serious, trauma-based horror movie.
Yeah.
These people, if you saw the original as, you know, Shudder gratefully is letting us do for the first time, as many problems as I have, I'm always happy when you can find a buried movie and show it to people just to be like, yeah, you know, we're going to correct this problem from decades ago. But it takes itself so seriously, and the characters in the first movie don't take any of it seriously. This idea that that they're traumatized by what happened, it's contradicted by the first movie. So
yeah, that's true.
That's one problem with it. The bigger problem, I think, is that it just doesn't work as a thriller. It doesn't work. There's so many things that are going wrong here.
Well, talk about characters doing stupid shit like in The Strangers. This one starts with the 30 years ago, this woman's dad was a night watchman at a morgue and was almost murdered or whatever. So her reaction to this is, I should go do that job at the same place now.
The job that caused her mother to die by suicide decades later.
It doesn't even care to justify that to you. It just goes, yeah, she's doing that. You get it. It's a legacy horror sequel.
It's a legacy horror sequel. The next generation has to do the exact same thing.
Yeah. So interesting ideas, honestly, like trauma haunting all these victims years later. But the movie just ends up kind of restaging the original in a way. And there's like a cool, creepy rubber Michael Myers style mask in this that I enjoyed. But like, I'm trying to think of like what this is. And this movie, it is just weird. It just like eventually becomes like a serial killer movie with a guy killing people, but it's all heavily based on you knowing the contents of this movie from 30 years ago because everyone's trauma from it is very centered to the point where, like, you know, we always joke about modern horror's obsession with trauma, but like, I can't believe it made its way to Denmark. Like, how did this happen? It doesn't really work. I don't know what else to say about it. It's the like bringing back the killer guy. Is there anything? I don't know what to say about it. I don't remember.
Yeah, because he's in a psychiatric institute now, the killer from the first movie, and apparently he survived. Somehow he survived. Somehow Vermeer is back.
Yeah, Vermeer. I love the name Vermeer.
Vermeer.
Very cool.
Vermeer is back. And
all of this could have been avoided, too, if the girl just didn't stir the pot with any of this. It feels like she's stirring apparently up the past. You know, I get the idea of the child of a victim is also fucked up by it. The movie's commenting on generations of trauma, but like that is just a horror trope at this point, elevated horror trope. So there's the same twists and reveals, basically, it feels like, as the other one.
I think if I remember right, I think this one tries to delay it and do a red herring. It tries to do two reveals at the exact same time to have one be a red herring. You know, what's really confusing is that I mistook who the actual killer was as I'm watching the movie because of the framing of the reveal was so weird that I thought, oh, that's the killer. And it turned out, no, it wasn't the killer. It's the other one that they were doing. And it's a weird thing. And maybe it's all on me. And maybe it was just that I was so like annoyed by the entire sequence of the double red herring and which one is which as it's going on that I just like, whatever. And then I realized, oh no, I just picked the wrong killer apparently, but whatever.
Yeah, I was excited to, like, you know, watch this sequel to a movie I'd never seen and watch them both back to back. And I didn't hate the first one. I thought it was a totally fine, probably would have given it 2.5 or 3 on this show. It was compelling enough. So if you're interested in watching this movie you've never seen 30 years ago, that's now available on Shudder, I would say watch the first one. I'm actually interested to see the Soderbergh written American one with Ewan McGregor that Wikipedia tells me at a festival it was like an hour and like it lost 30 minutes at some point by the time it became a release.
Sense. Yeah, maybe they cut out all the sex comedy stuff. Maybe it wasn't there originally.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's a 2-star movie for me. Night Watch, Demons Are Forever. It's just a really weird sequel that, like, because we don't have any history with it, it just feels like it came out of nowhere. And like, what's the point? It just felt like the Danish people had one horror movie, and they're like, legacy horror is the thing nowadays. Let's do the one with our one. And there we have it. Night Watch, Demons Are Forever on Shudder now is a 2-star movie for me. What about you?
1.5 for me.
There you have it. All right, this was our belated Monday episode. These movies came out a few days ago. I hope you're able to go see them or not, based on our advice, of course. Next week, one of my most anticipated movies of the summer, Furiosa, A Mad Max Saga. I could have made a joke there about how my most anticipated movie was Garfield, but I forgot. I'm talking too fast. And that's really it. Other stuff that doesn't sound interesting to me and I haven't really asked Mark about. So those are the events as far as I know. We'll be back with that and maybe more. MarkReviewsMovies.com for Mark's reviews. My reviews are all just here and on Letterboxd. Alien Ant Farm, take it away.
The show starts in one.
Shut up. Ush.